firefighters on 9/11, Michael felt a calling to serve his community and pursue his lifelong dream of becoming a firefighter. He devoted 14 years to his fire department, rising through the ranks to lieutenant, saving lives, mentoring younger firefighters, and earning the badge of honor for courage and selfless service. Tragically, Michael lost his battle with occupational cancer, leaving behind his loving wife, Katie, and their three children. His legacy reflects courage, compassion, and a lifelong commitment to protecting others. To honor Michael's sacrifice and ensure his family's stability, the foundation paid off the Wells family mortgage through their Fallen First Responder Home Program. Join us in the mission to do good and never forget America's heroes by visiting t2t.org to learn more and find Tunnel to Towers events near you.
If you miss a this is White Sox Weekly. Your all-access pass to everything White Sox.
Swing and a drive! Deep to left! Gone!
That was as hard as a baseball can be hit by anybody.
White Sox Weekly on the home of the White Sox, ESPN Chicago.
Now here's your host, Jeff Mellor.
Happy Saturday to you out there. I hope you're having a fabulous weekend so far. If you're a White Sox fan, your Chicago White Sox in first place, all alone, one game up on the Cleveland Guardians right now as we speak. And they sit there, partially because they took two of three from the Guardians this week here at Wright Field, and also partially because they put a whooping on the Kansas City Royals last night. What a majestic Friday evening, 22-1, folks. Unbelievable. It was a special night, as Will Venable called it after the game. Absolutely fantastic if you're a Sox fan. A beatdown of beatdowns. Have not seen one of those in, I can't remember when. Honestly, the Sox, the last time they scored 22 runs, that happened in 1970. Obviously, long before I was born. For most folks out there, probably long before you were born. And if you were born, who knows if you were even old enough to remember it at that point, because it happened so long ago. So the White Sox, what a way to start out a Friday night. Some interesting by Royals manager Matt Quatraro with his bullpen, which sets the White Sox up nicely for today. So we're going to relive the magic of last night here in a moment. But I do want to mention as well here today at the ballpark, another special day, as the 1983 winning ugly team, it is a reunion for them, going to have a fantastic day here at the ballpark with pregame festivities, a ceremony to honor the 83 team with lots of members of that great Sox team that won the AL West in attendance. So should be a fun day at the ballpark. We're also going to, throughout this White Sox Weekly, relive some of the best moments from the 83 season here as we get you set and prepped for the ceremony, which we will carry as much as we can on our pregame coverage, which will kick off at 2:30 today. But first things first, let's lock in and recap what we saw happen last night with the White Sox. And where to begin? Well, let's start in the third inning, the bottom of the third inning. Miguel Vargas with a couple runners aboard. Game was still without a score at this point, and Miggy set the tone, and the White Sox followed their leader.
Long hold, now a 1-1. Swing and a high fly ball out into deep left field. Collins back, and it's gone. That's a three-run jack for Vargas, and it's 3-0. And now Vargas is trying to catch Antonacci as they round the bases. They're having a little fun.
You got to love this. So Miguel Vargas always runs hard, running hard, as you heard Len describe, after homering as he was trying to run down Sam Antonacci, obviously jokingly. He was never going to pass him. But that's kind of Miguel Vargas's MO. And that will come up later in our highlight package here in an interesting way. But before we get to that, we continue on in the bottom of the third, as obviously the White Sox had themselves an early 3-0 lead. Chase Meidroth, who's had a tough last couple of weeks, came up with Kyle Teal on the bases, Andrew Benintendi as well, and Chase Meidroth started to break out of his funk.
The 2-1. Get on the ground toward the middle, bobbled by Rojas, throw to first, Save. Run scores. Rojas bobbled it a couple of times and was able to gather it. But by the time he threw to first base, it was too late. And it's 4-0.
So with Benintendi and Mydroth still on board, well, that brought Tristan Peters to the plate.
Tristan Peters hits a bouncer towards center. It's through. Benintendi's going to score. So will Mydroth. 6-0. Tristan Peters continues his fine work at the plate.
And I mentioned Mydroth being in a bit of a slump. Well, Jacob Gonzalez was in one as well, 0-for-25. And he came to the plate in the bottom of the third and found a way to break out of it in a big way with a couple runners aboard.
A 1-1. Hit in the air to right toward the corner. Caglione will not get it. It's a home run. You asked for 2 3-run homers, and you got them in the same inning. 9-0.
Yes, it was at that point a bit of a laugher. 9-0 in the bottom of the third. And the White Sox still were not done batting in the third. Miguel Vargas for a second time in the inning to drive home a run.
Long hold, now the pitch. Vargas shoots one out in the left center. It's going to get down there, all the way to the wall. Antonacci's going to score. Vargas has a double, sponsored by Tito's, and they've scored 10 runs in the inning.
Yeah, madness. 10 runs for the White Sox in the bottom of the third last night. They sent 14 hitters to the dish. Obviously, it felt like fait accompli at that point. Now, the Royals, you know, listen, they got themselves at the top of the fourth. Michael Massey brings home a run on a double play for KC. And the interesting thing about that is the bases were loaded because David Sandlin had walked the first three hitters that he faced in the inning. But I think you can attribute a large portion of that to the fact that David Sandlin had to do a long bit of waiting to get back on the mound. And I do want to tip of the cap to Sandlin as I'm talking about him right now, because he was brought up to make the spot start for the White Sox last night as they try and work through some of their injury issues. We'll have more on that in a bit, but nice start by David Sandlin, and really his only hiccup was when he had to wait 14 batters to go around and hit in the bottom of the third to get him that 10 runs of support. And then he came out and had a little bit of an issue with his control. But he got that double play that brought home the Royals' only run of the ball game. And after that, it was really not an issue the rest of the way for Sandlin. He had a 10-run lead, so all was well at that point. We moved to the bottom of the fifth. It's been a bit for Kyle Teal this season. Obviously, dealing with the injuries that he suffered, the hamstring in the WBC, and then the knee injury as he was trying to rehab and come back from the hamstring injury, which was a setback. But he's finally made his debut in the 2026 season this week. And last night, he finally got on the board with his first long ball of the year.
2-0. Teal in the air. Deep right. He's got his first home run. 13-1. Wow.
Wow, indeed. So the White Sox had themselves a 13-1 lead at that point. In the bottom of the sixth, though, they kept adding on as Tristan Peters would homer for the fifth time in the ballgame for the White Sox, which is, my friends, a new season high.
Peters hits a fly ball to right. It's deep, and it is a grand slam, 17-1.
Oh, my.
Insane. That's right. 17-1 at that point. 5 home runs on the game, including the grand slam from Tristan Peters, who now has 4 homers on the season, which for a guy who his pop was questioned coming into the season has proven that he's providing that. And with the defense that he's given the White Sox, it has been an absolute dream season for Tristan Peters, and in some ways I would say a dream season for Will Venable and Chris Getz because of what they're getting out of their center fielder, who is a key cog in why the White Sox have been so successful this year. But they weren't done yet. So at that point, the White Sox in the sixth inning ended up sending 8 batters to the plate. And then the seventh, friends, Chase Mydroth comes through, bringing home another one.
Mydroth lines into center field, base hit. Perez will score, 18-1.
Jacob Gonzalez followed that up.
There's a swing and a little bloop and a fair ball on the chalk in left. Acuna and Mydroth are going to score. It's 20-1. This is amazing.
Boy,
absolutely amazing.
Have a night.
Have a night. Yes, sir, DJ. And I would add, okay, 20-1. You would certainly understand. It would make all the sense in the world to, in a game which you lead by 19 runs and have already hit 20, it would certainly be understandable if a player was not necessarily busting it out of the box on a bounding ball with a potential double play on the line. But that, my friends, is not who Miguel Vargas is.
Vargas hits a one bounce and a third glove by Lofton. They'll get an out at second, and the relay is in time. I think Vargas beat it out, but we'll see if the White Sox will challenge it.
Man.
And he will.
Yeah, and you're doing this for one reason and one reason only, because your guy just busted his butt down the line to try and get that run batted in.
Yep. He might. The call is overturned. The runner is safe.
Yes, he was, and that was Miguel Vargas's fifth RBI of the game and the White Sox's 21st run of the game, and Kyle Teal would add on one more.
Swinging a ground ball into right. Gonzalez will score, 22-1.
So the White Sox finish off the game with a 22-1 victory, but I should mention we didn't, you know, not a whole lot of defensive highlights in last night's game, even though there were some nice plays made. We obviously only have so much time to bring you the highlights from the game, but we have to highlight the final out of the game. Nice defensive play by Chase Mydroth.
The 1-0. There's a bouncer. And Mydroth, throw to first. Wow. Game over.
Sure.
What a play.
Why wouldn't he? You're doing it for your pitcher. You're picking him up. Play the game hard all the way through, and Mydroth just did that.
Well, after all those one-run games against Cleveland, the Sox beat up on the Royals 22-1.
Wild game here last night at Wright Field. White Sox crushed the Royals. They've now won 5 straight against Kansas City. My, how times have changed. Think back the last few seasons, how the Royals have absolutely owned the White Sox, and to have a night like last night and a season like they're having against the Royals so far this year, it is some nice redemption for the White Sox, as they are now 42-38 on the season. And with that 22-1 game, a plus 21 in the run differential, the White Sox are now clearly on the positive side of the ledger with run differential for the season at plus 18. Yeah, a game like that obviously goes a long ways. And I will note, it's nice to put one of those in your back pocket, because it kind of makes amends for that early, you know, the first 6 games out of the gate where the White Sox absolutely let the run differential get away from them. Obviously, run differential ultimately doesn't mean anything when it comes to trying to figure out the standings. But what you always want to point to, and one of the reasons I harp on it, is the record you have halfway through a season is not really predictive or indicative of what type of season you can expect your team to have as the season progresses. However, run differential, that's something that you can look at and say, okay, this is a little bit more predictive of what type of team we have here. And the White Sox now at plus 18, halfway through the season. And I say, they're starting to show you why they are more than a viable choice to win the AL Central and at the very least be in the playoff competition here as we head into the summer months, with the White Sox clearly in good position as they continue to do this. Also, by the way, 21 runs without 21-run victory. They continue to do this without Munetaka Murakami, who yesterday was taking some swings in the cage. I believe Will Venable called him 85% when it comes to running right now. So he is on the mend, hoping to have him back in the next couple of weeks. You know, it might be right around the All-Star break, so we can see. It wouldn't shock me if the White Sox, if you're right around the All-Star break, you just give him the entire break and wait it until, you know, the first games after the All-Star break, if you're right on that threshold, just to ensure that he's completely back from a hamstring injury, because obviously that's one of those injuries where you're always a little bit concerned about potential re-injuries. So, but again, they have not really skipped a beat without Munetaka Murakami, which just gets you really excited about the possibilities about where they're at when he does return to their lineup. 312-332-3776. As always, that's the number if you want to jump aboard and talk about your White Sox with me after an absolute demolishing of the Royals last night. We are here at Raitt Field right now on Saturday afternoon getting set for the 1983 reunion ceremony as the White Sox celebrate their winning ugly team today. Going to have a pregame ceremony prior to first pitch. So it's a festive day at the ballpark after an absolutely beautiful evening last night. How could it get any better on a Saturday afternoon? Sox fans, join us at Raitt Field for Nickelodeon Day tomorrow. Today, or even if you are, come out tomorrow as well. June 28th, as the White Sox take on these Royals at 1:10, you receive a slime bucket hat when you purchase a specially priced ticket. Limited availability, plus watch out for slime around the ballpark. Purchase tickets and prepaid parking. Visit whitesox.com/promos. Jeff Meller here at the ballpark. When we come back, for all the good he did, unfortunately, baseball, it can be ruthless. I will fill you in on that, and we'll hear from White Sox skipper Will Venable about what last night was like when we come back right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Sandlin ready, and a 1-2 on the way. He got him swinging. He stayed upstairs, went a little higher on that heater, and picks up his first strikeout. Swing and a miss, strike three on a high fastball.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
3-2. He struck him out on a hook.
That was beautiful.
What I did there?
Right on the hook.
2-2. He struck him out swinging on a sweeper. That was a strange inning for Sandlin, but he only gave up a run. Swing and a miss, and Witt is out, where some guys maybe get out of their game, right?
I agree. I think you described it perfectly, yep.
Called strike three, so they fail to score. We head to the bottom of the sixth.
David Sandlin last night picks up his second victory on the season. Six strong innings, one earned run, struck out six, only walked three, only allowed three hits. Of course, the White Sox gave him 10 runs of support in the bottom of the third, which is exactly what you want your offense to do. Spot your young rookie starter a huge lead and let him just go out there and attack, and Sandlin was able to do that. Of course, the harsh realities of big league baseball are that you do your job well, and then sometimes if you have options remaining and the team wants the extra arm in the bullpen, well, you can always be optioned back to AAA. And love the work by Sandlin. Unfortunately, the White Sox today, prior to their game against the Royals, have recalled left-handed pitcher Tyler Schweitzer from AAA Charlotte, and they have optioned right-hander David Sandlin back to Charlotte. Just a numbers game for Sandlin, where Noah Schultz, who also started last night, I believe, is probably in line to take the next start. Now, that has not been official. This is just me reading the tea leaves, but I think the plan is going to be for Noah Schultz to take the next start where the Sandlin spot from last night would come up. So, no days off here. So we're to, you know, 5 days from now, or 5 days from last night. I would expect that Noah Schultz, in all likelihood, will probably be back on the Major League roster. He struck out seven last night in 4 2/3 innings in his rehab at AAA. So I would suspect that we'll get Schultz activated here soon, and that is partially why Salen was optioned back down. Now they've got the extra reliever in their pen as well. As I always say, if you want to talk some White Sox with me, 312-332-3776. Looks like we have a caller in Mount Greenwood. Pete, what's going on, PD?
Hey, Jeff, like listening to you, fantastic. You do a great job.
But thank you, man.
Ask a couple things, one question and another thing I want to ask a point. Mm-hmm. First, Everson Pereira, I think if you ever stay on the field, is going to be big because we need a right-handed bat against the lefties. Is there any update on his concussion
protocol? I've seen him in the clubhouse a couple times this week. I can't say that I've spoke with him, so I have not particularly myself talked about it. You know, that's the 7-day concussion IL. So when he's feeling good, obviously, I believe he'll be eligible to return. I don't know. Again, I haven't heard Will give an update about a specific timeline for him, Pete. So I can't tell you exactly when he will be returning. I agree with you, though. Obviously, they see a lot that they like. He does have some nice pop. Yes. He's got the ability to play center field as well. He's kind of a nice, addition to the roster when you look up and down. But what I will say is that, Pete, since Junior Perez has come up, he's done a nice job here in the limited opportunities that he's had for the White Sox. So, I can't necessarily say that it seems like it's always just the next man up right now with this White Sox team, and they're doing a good job. So, the question would be, I think Junior Perez will probably be the odd man out when Pereira is ready to return. But it's nice to have options and depth, organizational depth.
The other thing, I'd like to know if they. Because I know it's 7 days has passed yesterday, but anyways, maybe you could ask Will. But the other quick thing I had, all these people that they keep talking and want to make these trades to get, with Noah Schultz coming back and Murakami and maybe Tanner McDougal, I don't want to give up these young guys. I mean, we suffered for the last 3 years. I don't want to lose these guys.
Sure.
And we could have another 3 or 4 years of good baseball.
Sure,
I agree with that.
I agree with you, Pete. I love what they've been able to do. Again, I just said it, organizational depth. It finally feels like the White Sox have done, and credit to Chris Getz with all the hirings that he's made in terms of to help the player development, right? Now you're seeing the players in the minor leagues actually hit some of that potential and get to it, that untapped potential that you're always dreaming on. And it feels like the White Sox now with Brian Bannister and Ryan Fuller overseeing the pitching and hitting aspects underneath Chris Getz. I mean, I think they're doing a fantastic job, and I think they have one cohesive message from the top of the organization down, which really does help with the development. In terms of like giving away a young player to add to this team, it kind of depends on what they're looking for. I'll be honest, I love what they're doing. I just, and this is something that Chris Getz has said the last time he addressed the media, but every team is always looking to add pitching. That's just the reality of it, and you can never have enough. And even when you feel like you're in a good spot, you still want to add some more because in all likelihood, you're not going to get through an entire, from June 27th through October. If you end up playing in October, you're not going to get through unscathed with pitching injuries. It's the reality of the game. So you need to add, and I think, you mentioned Tanner McDougal. He still is, probably maybe a week or so away from a Adams. He's somebody who is working his way back from Tommy John surgery. He's been pitching a little bit, and I understand that, so you've got some depth in the organization. We saw Salen, obviously, last night. So it's nice that they have some arms. It really depends, though. If you get a quality starting pitcher, somebody like Reed Detmers from the Angels, who look like they're out of it as they fired their general manager last night. Reed Detmers to me is somebody who has another year of control after this season, and it looks like he's really turned the corner as well. He's been doing some really nice things. Big strikeout pitcher, avoids contact, doesn't walk a whole lot of hitters. At least this year he hasn't. So, you know, if you can make a move for someone like him and still have another year of control after this season with him in your rotation as a, you know, a lefty who can strike a lot of people out, I'm intrigued, you know, but I don't know what the cost would be. So it's a delicate balancing act, but again, you can never have enough pitching, and I think that's just the reality of the situation. 312-332-3776, again, that's the number if you want to jump aboard. I did mention Will Venable. We'll get to that here on the other side of a quick timeout, but let's pause 10 seconds for stations to identify themselves.
This is ESPN Chicago, home of the White Sox. WMVP WTBC HD2 Chicago, a Good Karma Brands radio station.
Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly at Rate Field today. Grab your friends and head out to Rate Field for Miller Lite Baseball and Brews. You get one ticket and two beers starting at $24. You must be 21 and over with a valid ID. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/brews. When we come back, I'll let you hear Will Venable's reaction to last night's game. This is the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Long hold, now a 1-1. Swing and a high fly ball out into deep left field. Collins back, and it's gone. That's a three-run jack for Vargas, and it's 3-0. And now Vargas trying to catch Antonacci as they round the bases. They're having a little fun. Peters hits a fly ball to right. It's deep, and it is a grand slam. 17-1.
Oh my!
Some of the sounds from last night here at Rate Field as the White Sox absolutely walloped the Kansas City Royals 22-1. They have won 9 straight series here at Rate Field. They go for their 10th series win with a win here today. Of course, they can also win it with a win tomorrow after taking the opener last night. Hey, Sox fans! Get a ticket plus a free meal. Grab your family and head to the ballpark with a family pack starting at $21 for select games. Each ticket purchase includes one hot dog, a drink, chips, and a cookie. For tickets, visit whitesox.com/family. It was just a fun night to be here at the ballpark. Had a post-game concert as well. Marshmello performing after a raucous crowd got to see their favorite baseball team absolutely crush. And Will Venable, what did you think of last night's performance?
Special. It was a special night. You know, really good stuff up and down the lineup. Everyone contributed. The guys off the bench did a nice job. And as good as our offense was, I thought our pitching was great too.
You had 3 guys with more than 5 RBIs and a bunch of hits across. I think everyone but Braden had a hit. Everyone got a base. Literally everyone that played. Is there any way to pinpoint 1 or 2 guys, or is it just a group thing?
Just a good team effort right there. You know, everyone came in with a plan. You know, one of those days where we knew we were getting an opener ahead of somebody. We knew Spence was going to take probably the bulk of it. You know, one of those days where you have to be on top of your game planning and make adjustments, you know, at bat to at bat, and they did a great job.
It's a divisional game. It's obviously the first game of the series. You wind up using a lot of guys. Is there kind of a merit to continuing to push to drain as much resources as you can?
For sure. You know, it's part of this. You know, they're going to be in a spot where I'm sure they'll, you know, make some adjustments and they'll have these guys ready to go the next couple of days, but certainly having them use so many guys is just to our benefit.
Sam had that spot where you have a little loose and put the back together. How much growth is that going to take some of the life from him tonight? Just getting back into the way he's
Yeah, really good job getting back on track and really attribute that to a really long sit in that inning when we scored the 10 runs and, you know, he had to find his way back and was able to do it. You know, obviously, you know, 3 walks is not the way you want to start an inning, but you got to get back on track, and he did.
Well, they always say in games like this, they're always running to the back rack, just, you know, get up there. But what is the feeling in a dugout when things like this are happening?
Oh, it's good. Obviously, you know, you hit some balls hard, you make some good swing decisions. I thought we benefited from some balls that, you know, bounced our way at the same time, and I think that's how you get to a night like this where you're able to score so many runs.
What does that particularly stood out to you there during the 10-run game?
Yeah, just guys passing the baton. You know, it was just one good at bat after the other, and, you know, pretty quickly you got a special inning.
You challenged, I think, like 20-1, but Vargas that's running out the back. You kind of like want to respect the effort there a little bit, or is it kind of
of your process and just the challenge, whatever it is.
No, it's about Vargas there and his effort down the line, and he did everything that he could to put himself in a spot to get that RBI and not have them turn a double play. You also don't want to just give them an out there that, you know, they haven't gotten, and to have Lynch pitch more, you know, makes a difference too. So it really started with Vargas, though, just running so hard. I thought he deserved that challenge.
You heard Will talk about Miguel Vargas earning that RBI. He absolutely did. The call was overturned rightly. And Vargas now has 50 RBIs on the season. I love this as the baseball nerd in me. We're 80 games through the season. So after today's game, we will be exactly halfway through the Major League Baseball season. And I love it because you can always look at stats now and just double them and be like, all right, this is the pace he's on. This is what we got. And obviously, it's baseball. It never works that way, ever. Rarely. I mean, it's such an oddity. But for whatever reason, as long as I've been, you know, watching and just consuming baseball, it never leaves me. I just can't help myself. I'm back to being a 12-year-old kid looking at box scores, and then we get to the halfway point. I'm like, all right, here we go, halfway numbers. And so Miguel Vargas with that RBI now has 50. So at bare minimum, after the end of today's game, we can go ahead and project Miguel Vargas for 100 RBI season. With 18 homers, he's pacing for 36 dongs and 10 stolen bases. Could be a 30-20 guy, folks. He's on pace for 20 stolen bases, and he has an OPS of 841. So that would be one hell of a season for Miguel Vargas. Of course, Colson Montgomery already has 20 home runs for 40. You know, Andrew Benintendi on pace for 20 home runs. He has been an absolute lifesaver in the middle of the order since Munetaka Murakami has gone down. And how about this? Sam Antonacci? Listen, it doesn't quite work for Sam because he obviously missed about the first, 18 games or so this season because he didn't, he was still in the minor leagues before he got the call. But what a season he's having so far, hitting .294 with a .393 on base, a .417 slug. Sam Antonacci has an OPS over 800 right now. He's also taken to being a little more aggressive on the base paths. He's got 11 steals, so he's pacing for over 20 stolen bases on the season right now. I mean, lots to like. And, of course, Munetaka Murakami, who we've met for, you know, over three weeks now, he's already on pace for 40 home runs, even if he doesn't play another ball game here, which he won't until, you know, we get closer to the All-Star break. But because of what he's been able to accomplish in the early season, he's on pace for 40 home runs. So just, you know, I love that midway point as just something to look at with the White Sox. And, oh, yeah, by the way, Davis Martin has himself a chance after today, which, again, if he could pick up a win today, Davis Martin would have 10 on the season, 81 games into the season. You know what that means, 20-game winner if you double that number. So, again, fun with numbers halfway through the season. The White Sox look like a really good baseball team. One thing I wanted to note to you after that Will Venable presser after the game, how about the fact that the White Sox batted around twice last night? I mean, that's just absurd. 14 batters to the plate in the third inning, and then again in the seventh, they send 10 batters to the plate. Not just batting around, but double-digit batters to the plate. Absolutely wild night last night here at Wright Field. And one point I mentioned before we take a quick timeout, I'm not quite sure why Matt Quatraro chose to unload the bullpen last night. You know, and he went to a lot of his most trusted relievers. Now, Mitch Spence, who was the bulk man last night, clearly they were hoping he could give them some length last night, and that was just not the case. He got lit up in the third inning, couldn't get an inning in the third, and gave up 10 earned runs. Quatraro just had to pull the plug. But after that, the curious choice was, after he turned to Beckway, he then went to Lucas Erceg, which, okay, Erceg, he was the closer for a little bit early in the season, but he has definitely been struggling a lot over the last, we'll call it, month. So Erceg, I understand giving him the ball. But then he goes to John Schreiber, who's been pretty solid this year with a 3.31 ERA. Then he goes to Alex Lang, who, even though his he got lit up. He came into the game with a decent ERA sub four. He was in the three near low threes last night. Alex Lang gets hit up for 5 earned runs in a third of an inning. Alex Lang has been the guy who has been basically closing out games since they removed Urseg from that role. Then, after Lang can't get out of an inning, Quatraro turns to Daniel Lynch. And Daniel Lynch, honestly, has been the Royals' most effective reliever all season long. He's a lefty. So I don't know why Quatraro, in a game losing by double digits early, chose to use all of his best relievers. But that certainly could end up benefiting the White Sox, because if they're in close ball games the next 2 days, you know, those relievers have been taxed a little bit. And if he goes to them today, it's possible that a lot of those guys are available on Sunday, because rarely do you see pitchers pitch back-to-back-to-back days anymore in 2026. So a little bit of a curious bullpen management by Royals manager Matt Quatraro yesterday, which I just found a little bit puzzling, if I do say so myself. Hey, join us at the ballpark Friday, July 10th for Mexican Heritage Night as the White Sox take on the Athletics at 6:40. 15,000 fans, 21 and older, will receive a Mexican Heritage jersey presented by Topo Chico Hard Seltzer. And be sure to stay after for a post-game fireworks show. To purchase tickets and prepaid parking, visit whitesox.com/promos. Jeff Meller here at Right Field, White Sox Weekly, as we do every Saturday, 2 hours prior to our pregame coverage. Pregame coverage starting officially at 2:30 today. A reminder, it is 1983 reunion weekend today, celebration of the winning ugly team on the field before first pitch. So we're going to carry that for you during our pregame show at 2:30. So fun day here at the ballpark as the White Sox go for their 10th straight series win here at Right Field. When we come back, Len Casper, the voice of the White Sox, joined Waddle and Sylvie yesterday here on the flagship station ESPN Chicago, and just talked about where the White Sox have been so far this year and, you know, why the expectations are real. We'll let you hear that conversation coming up next on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Hand him another one. Randall Grichuk in the air. Deep left. We are tied.
No way they do it again. Come on.
Oh, baby.
Boy, there is magic in the air around this ballpark for the White Sox players. It has just happened so consistently for so long now.
There's magic in the air for this team at Right Field. There's magic in the air on this day as the White Sox are getting set to honor the 1983 winning ugly team. It's funny, we're playing a highlight from a game this week, the only game this week here at Right Field that the White Sox did not win. Think about that. Because Randall Grichuk, with that highlight that you heard Len Casper call and Darren Jackson comment on, that tied the ball game with, that was the second of back-to-back jacks by Braden Montgomery and Randall Grichuk in the ninth inning to force extra innings on Wednesday after a nearly 3-hour rain delay. And the White Sox end up losing in the 10th. But, of course, that was on the heels of taking the first two from the Guardians. And you know, it's just, it's amazing that, you know, they have these moments, so many ridiculous moments all season long. We haven't even had a chance to hit on Sam Antonacci walking it off on Monday night against the Guardians, a game in which Sir Anthony Dominguez blew the save and Grant Taylor certainly wasn't at his best either. And the team just keeps finding different ways to win. I don't know if it's winning ugly, because it feels like they're winning in these fantastic ways. So it's interesting. We've got the celebration again of the 83 winning ugly team here today. But this team is just unbelievable and has provided so many fantastic moments for the fan base that I don't care. Listen, I don't know where this season's going, but all I can tell you is this is 2026. Forgettable year for White Sox fans already. And again, we're playing game 81 here today. So it was interesting to hear Len Casper have another great call and with that Randall Grichuk home run. And that is where Sylvie of Waddle and Sylvie began with his questioning of Len Casper as he joined the guys yesterday on our afternoon show on ESPN Chicago.
We were joking the other day as we play your highlight. I've watched you for years because I'm a Cubs fan, as I've mentioned before to you, that like I used to be the voice of my team on television. And maybe it was because it was TV. I don't remember you going like to that pitch that you've gone to now. The first time I remember that happening, and maybe I just wasn't charting my Len Casper calls correctly, was at the Field of Dreams game with the game-winning home run. And do you have a nickname for when you get to this higher tone? This, as Rich Eisen calls it, a higher register.
It's just when stuff happens kind of out of the blue. It's the first pitch of an at-bat. Something kind of unexpected happens, and you just kind of, it is what it is. I guess that's what I call it. You kind of, in a way, stop being a broadcaster, and you just are a fan, and you kind of live in that moment. And I don't plan it. I just try to really stay true to whatever's happening at that time. And we probably had a couple of these games in the last 2 years, but they didn't mean as much, right? So I think when it starts to matter that the games that are won have resonance in the standings and the fans are excited, I think that just kind of all leads into that extra excitement. But it's not on purpose. It's just kind of reacting.
You've always mentioned, too, and you've told me, both on and off the air, how much you enjoy doing radio. Do you get a kick, too, that, like, on television, like, the voice doesn't have to alert us to much because we're watching, and we could see the ball with a launch angle, and it's got a chance, and sure, you're describing it, but, like, you're alerting us what we can't see with your voice. And do you think that you've become like more into fan mode because of that, because someone in their car has no clue where the ball is hit?
I definitely have to say more on radio because I have to describe what's happening. You know, ball is in the air. Is it hit the left field? Is it shallow? Is it deep? All of those things tend to, you know, have to be included in the call. So there's just kind of more words involved, but yeah, I guess that's a good way to think about it. I do think on the radio, your tone and your excitement or disappointment at certain moments, you have to maybe accentuate those things a little bit for the listener. But again, it just comes from experience, I guess. And just, you know, let's put it this way. These are not my favorite calls because I'm not a broadcaster and in those moments. And I feel like I should be more of a broadcaster. But it is amazing how many people say, "Oh, I heard your call. It was great." So if people like it, then I'm good with it. You know, again, I don't love hearing the calls over and over again. But, you know, I'm a perfectionist. And I kind of want to, you know, hit every note correctly on every call. But I really pride myself on not having a standard line that I'll use, because I do think that if you repeat the same thing over and over, at a certain point, it loses a little bit of its special nature. And I think every play has its own unique characteristics, and I want to serve it that way.
There have been so many exciting moments. I still believe, because I'm wired differently, I'm going to hear a swear come out of the booth at some point.
From DJ.
DJ, like, yeah. One of these days, Len, I'm here waiting to, no effing way!
I think we all are waiting for that. And he's sitting right here chuckling, so I think he even agrees with you. I love it. It never gets in the way of my call, but I just love that he gets it. And that's how it should be. And again, whether or not this team had the last 3 years before it, I'm sure elevated those excitement moments for the both of us, because we lived through that. And I still, you know, look at the record and go, I cannot believe that this team went 41-121. I mean, we actually lived it, but it doesn't seem real in a lot of ways. But to have all of this happen just 2 years later is just remarkable, and it says so much about this organization and how quickly things have changed.
Len, one of my favorite things about this team is they get down, they don't. You lose three in a row in Detroit, you come home, you take two or three from Cleveland. Is there a tangible explanation for the resilience of this crew?
I don't know if there's a real answer to that question. It is a good question, but I do think one tenet of being a very good team is that you don't let a three-game losing streak turn into a 7 or 8. And if you just limit those bad stretches, it is hugely helpful. I think the longest winning streak is 5. The longest losing streak is 3. And I've looked at inside the numbers, guys, and trying to find, you know, any underlying stuff that would seem to indicate that this team is better or worse than its record. It's legit. I mean, I don't think you can find anything under the hood that would lead you to say that halfway through the season that the White Sox are playing over their heads by any stretch of the imagination. They've been really good in one-run games, but they were really bad in one-run games. And I think when you average a run more per game, and they're almost at a run better this year than they were last year, and you hit home runs, you're going to win 3-2 more often than you lose 3-2. And the identity of this club is slug, and even when you're behind, you still have a chance to come back and win. And then I think on the pitching side, you know, it hasn't been in the overall statistically great, but some really big performances along the way. I think, you know, Sean Newcomb and Sean Burke the other day, what an incredible performance. There was nobody available in the bullpen. And so just that resilient nature, I think, is not just for the position player group, but I think for the pitching staff as well.
I know it's obvious that, you know, it's easier to play at home than it is on the road. You win more at home usually than you lose, you know, than you win on the road. But is there anything to why this team has struggled so mightily away from the rate?
The only stat I can think of is they have the best home ERA in the league, and that number is and the rotation. Let's see, the rotation at home, 3.18, 5.50 on the road. Mm-hmm. So that probably explains it more than anything. For whatever reason, they're really comfortable pitching in this ballpark, and it has been a struggle on the road. Aside from that, I think the home road stuff gets a little overblown. I do think the fan support doesn't hurt. But you just like to bat last, and I think that's probably the main reason they've been so good at home.
And they made the most out of their last at-bats, as Waddle mentioned, the resilience and the big picture and the smaller picture, too. Len, Mooney took batting practice today. I saw Chuck Garfine tweeted out some video. I guess he's getting closer here. I mean, this is a vital piece to what the White Sox do, and they've kept the rig on the road with him out. What are you expecting here with Mooney soon?
Saw him take some ground balls today. He was in the cage with everybody else. I think Will said he's at about 85%. They obviously don't want to push him too hard. I think that's a real tricky injury for any baseball player. But let's put it this way. If he's ready a few days before the All-Star break, I don't think they would hesitate to activate him and not maybe give him 3 or 4 extra days. So I don't think they'll slow play it, but I don't think that there is a sense of urgency because you don't want to re-injure that hamstring. And you're right. The way this team has responded, Andrew Benintendi's had his best stretch of the year since Murakami got hurt. Vargas had that really good stretch. Colson hits home runs in bunches. And I think having Braden Montgomery here has been a huge benefit as well. Maybe at the end of the year, guys, this injury will actually help the club because we might not have seen Braden Montgomery in the major leagues had Murakami not gotten injured.
It's a great point. Great point. And so how good can this White Sox offense be when now that Teal's back and he's only had 7 at bats, so now that you can't judge anything and he's been off for so long, and when Murakami comes back with the rest of the group who's been quite the good offense this year?
I just think that it lengthens your lineup a lot. If Teal is going to be a middle-of-the-order hitter, I think Murakami will bat 2nd or 3rd, and then that just might move Colson Montgomery down to maybe 6. If Colson Montgomery is your 6th hitter, I think you feel really, really good about your lineup. And there's just damage from top to bottom. Mydroth, you know, leads off against lefties. Antonacci leads off against righties. But when those guys are not in the leadoff spot, they can kind of hit anywhere in the lineup as well. So I think this lineup has a chance to be a 5-run per game or better, and that puts you in the top 5 in the league.
If the Sox are leading 2-1 tonight, heading into the top of the 9th, who do you expect to get the baseball?
I guess it depends on who's pitched before. I think that they're all about matchups and pockets in the lineup, and I think it could be anybody. I think what you're getting at is, would it be Sir Anthony Dominguez? I don't know the answer to how they plan on using him moving forward. My guess is it might be a little lower leverage spot, but I think Hudson's in play. If Newcomb's available, I think he would be in play, and I think Grant Taylor would also be a possibility.
Newcomb could throw, Ken. I mean, you mentioned it earlier. Like, that outing the other day was spectacular. It's something that you already discussed, but he can fill the role, can't he, Len?
He's been their best reliever, and it won't probably happen, but he's all-star worthy. He's done so many different things. I think he would start in a second if you asked him to be a part of the rotation. But I think the main thing for him, guys, is get him to 100 innings plus, however he gets there, whether it's opening for three innings, throwing two and a third in the middle of the game, or closing. And as long as he's amenable to do that, I think that he'll continue to do what he's been doing.
Len, when was the last time that net behind you was used successfully in the booth?
Never.
Never?
No. I mean, it's really a bad... I should have a glove, but if I did this and put it in front of my face, the ball would probably come and hit me.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. Yeah.
So I kind of would have to do it, you know, off to the side a little bit.
Yeah.
But it's a nice prop, though, right?
Yeah, it looks great.
So what is it? Is it a fishing net? What kind of net is that?
Minnow.
Yes. For minnows, I'm told.
Oh, okay. Minnows. For minnows.
It was DJ's comment. Did you hear it was DJ's comment?
How long
was it?
Paul Zerang.
That's a Zerang thing. Those Zerang kids, you know, you got to look out for
that. Keep an eye on
especially
them.
Especially on a Bears broadcast. You never know what you're going to get, Len. Yeah.
That's right. You see the big ESPN 1000 sign in the background, too.
Oh, yeah. Very nice. Yeah. Very nice.
We're all set up for video and audio here, babe.
I love that. By the way, Grichik, like when the Sox got Grichik, I'm like, what are they doing with Grichik? But man, where, like,
then Vassell tapped him with the wand and he's right. Become magic. Yeah,
but wait, like Len, I could say that about a million guys on this team, but where would they be without some of these Grichik pinch hits and the leadership and what he can do on a fill in basis?
It really started with Derek Hill. And now it's Grichik, but it's the veteran guy with a lot of experience who is a great teammate, and it's kind of a career renaissance here for Grichik. These are the types of guys you have when you have a really special season, and I don't know how you can replicate it. And along those lines, you know, this team should be really good in the years to come, but I think there's an understanding at the special quality of what's happening around this club right now. And you can probably add via trade or whatever some things that this team lacks, but I don't think you can add what they already have. Mm-hmm. And that is that resilience that you guys talked about at the front. This division is open. This entire American League is open. What are there, three teams that have a positive run differential in the American League? I think the sky's the limit for this group, and I think that guys like Grichik are showing you that it can be a really special year. I don't know how long Randall will play, but at the end of when it's all said and done, this might be one of the best years and most fun years of his entire career.
So you're not putting any like ceiling on this year in particular?
No, you cannot really predict year to year how you're going to be, and no matter how good this team is next year, it won't be the same team, right? Because there's just every season is its own thing. And right now, the White Sox are in first place halfway through the season. Detroit is having a tough year. Cleveland's without Ramirez. Witt's coming back tonight, but the Royals are well under 500, and the Twins are in a rebuild. So why would you wait? And I think that everyone here acknowledges that, and I think they're in go-for-it mode.
So that being said, a player like Jacob Gonzalez, who was having a really good year down on the farm, and he's a middle infielder. He's been playing first out of necessity, and they're also developing a skill set here. Where do you look at it when they say, look, he's hitting .189, he's been overmatched at times, there's been a mishap at first or here or there. do they look at that and they say, we need better results? Or do they say, hey, look, we're developing a first round pick on the major league level. We're cool living with some struggles.
I can't speak for the front office or for the manager, but I would say my guess is they would say, we're not developing at the big league level. We're trying to win baseball games at the major league level. Development happens naturally for young players as they go through some struggles, but I don't think the goal is to let a guy struggle here to figure it out, especially in a year like this. Right now, Gonzalez is playing first because Murakami is on the injured list. And when Murakami comes back, they'll have to clear a spot, and it might be Jacob, it might be somebody else. So I guess the long answer to your question is, if there were a better option right now, I don't think they would hesitate to do it. And he had two hits the other day to snap an 0-for-28. He's in the lineup again tonight, and we've seen some good at-bats from him, and hopefully that'll continue.
That was Len Casper as he joined Waddle and Sylvie yesterday. Lots of great stuff there. Hey, Sox fans, pre-gaming made easy. Treat your group to a patio party, 2 hours of all-you-can-eat, plus unlimited beer, wine, and Coca-Cola products. For more information, visit whitesox.com/partyareas or call 312-674-1000. Got a starting lineup for you for both squads when we come back. This is the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Carmen and Yurko, weekdays, 9 to noon, ESPN Chicago.
Any kind of something to score a run, and the Sox will grab the golden ring. You see Harold second in game-winning RBIs. You couldn't ask for a better man to stand at the plate than that. And Del Crandall is going to bring the infield in. The outfield is shallow. Vandenberg will work from the stretch. And that is into shallow center. It's just for the run. Cruz tags. Here's the catch. Here comes the throw. Here comes Cruz. And that's from the golden ring. The Chicago White Sox, the 1983 Western champions in the American League. And you think there aren't some happy people on the field. All right. Harold Bain with the game-winning RBI. The White Sox win it 4-3.
Winning ugly, the sack fly by Harold Baines to clinch the AL West division crown in 1983. And the White Sox are getting set for the reunion today to celebrate that fantastic season. White Sox fans, obviously, who have been around, who have seen some things, have a warm heart for the team led by Tony La Russa, which ultimately ended the 24-year drought for the White Sox to win a division. And obviously lots of iconic members of that team expected to be here in attendance today. Of course, led by Harold Baines, who you heard right there with that sack fly winner. Of course, the Bull, Greg Luzinski, the 32-year-old DH that season, who launched 32 home runs, three of which were on the rooftop at Old Comiskey Park. Of course, Ron Kittle, Kitty, in his rookie year, his rookie of the year season, the only season that Ron Kittle made the All-Star team in the American League. He hit 35 bombs, 100 ribbies. Obviously, huge linchpin to the offense. Vance Law at third base. Of course, Julio Cruz, who the White Sox traded for, key part as the leadoff man for the, Julio Cruz and Rudy Law, both critical pieces on that 83 team. Carlton Fisk, Tom Pachorik. And then, of course, the rotation led by Lamar Hoyt, who won 24 games that year. Richard Dotson also won 22 himself. Floyd Bannister, Brian's father, Brian, the man who heads the White Sox pitching infrastructure here these days, and probably one of the reasons why Brian wanted to come back to Chicago, because he obviously grew up here as a child, because Floyd spent so many great years as a member of the White Sox. He won 16 that year. Britt Burns, of course, Jerry Koosman, Dennis Lamp, your leading save man, the closer. Obviously, a little bit different back in 83, the way bullpen usage was. I just love looking at the innings pitched by Lamar Hoyt, 260. Richard Dotson, 240. Floyd Bannister, 217. It's like you have to put together the leading, you know, whatever. If you go across baseball, take the leader in innings on every team and then probably find the reliever who threw the most innings to get to the amount of number that Lamar Hoyt and Richard Dotson were throwing in 83. Just love it. But, yeah, we're going to be celebrating the 1983 winning ugly team again under Tony La Russa as well. So it should be fun festivities here at the ballpark today. We're going to bring that pregame ceremony to you during our pregame show around 2:30 this afternoon. Lineup for today's game, it'll be Sam Antonacci leading off in left field. It'll be Miguel Vargas playing third base and batting second. Andrew Benintendi, the DH, hits third. Colson Montgomery, left-handed hitting shortstop, cleaning up. Trice Mydroth at second base, batting fifth. Braden Montgomery in right field, the switch hitter, hitting sixth. Tristan Peters in center, lefty, bats eighth. Jacob Gonzalez, lefty first baseman, hitting eighth. And then Drew Romo behind the plates, your switch hitting catcher to give Kyle Teal day off. Obviously, Will Venable being extra cautious with Kyle Teal as he returns from that injury to make sure that he doesn't get overworked here early on. Then for the Royals, it'll be Carter Jensen leading off at DH. Bobby Witt Jr. back in the field today at shortstop, batting second. Jack Caglione at first base, hitting third. Lane Thomas in center, batting cleanup. Michael Massey at second base, the lefty, hits fifth. Salvador Perez behind the plate today, hitting sixth. John Rave in right field, lefty, hits seventh. Nick Lofton at third base, batting eighth. And then Isaac Collins in left field, the switch hitter, rounds out Matt Quatraro's lineup. It'll be Davis Martin on the hill for the White Sox up against Michael Wacha. When we come back, a fun conversation earlier this week on Wednesday when Horace Grant was in the house getting ready to celebrate Horace Grant Day. He joined me during Rain Delay Theater, so we're going to bring you some of that conversation, if you missed it, right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
The Rich Eisen Show, weekdays, noon to 2, ESPN Chicago.
Join us at the ballpark Saturday, July 11th, as the White Sox face the Athletics at 110. Come early for a pregame Major League Baseball draft watch party. That's right, folks. And speaking of the draft, I'm going to talk to Josh Nelson here at 2 o'clock about what the White Sox should do. But yeah, come join us for that MLB draft watch party. Enjoy 20% off all food and beverage from 11:40 to 1 o'clock. Plus, be sure to stay after the game for, that's right, the post-game alumni home run derby presented by Blue Moon. You must be 21 and older to purchase tickets. Visit whitesox.com/derby. Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly. Had a fun conversation with three-time NBA champ with the Chicago Bulls. Also grabbed one more with the Lakers, but obviously we don't need to talk about that. But Horace Grant was in the house on Wednesday throwing out the first pitch and getting ready to celebrate Horace Grant Day, which was set to take place the next day. That was Thursday. So Ho Grant, Mr. Rec Specs himself, joined me in the booth. And, of course, sad news we learned of the loss of Stacey King a couple weeks ago, and that's obviously where I wanted to begin. And just, I mentioned to Horace Grant how I know whoever the Bulls bring in to sit in that chair next to Adam Amin will no doubt be somebody who does a fantastic job, but nevertheless, Bulls broadcast without Stacey King will just never be the same.
It's, I mean, what a loss for the Chicago family, definitely his family and the city. Stacey King was a man that I remember as it was yesterday, back in the day when we were winning the championships, if we lost a game, everybody would get on the bus a little tense and, you know, kind of not, you know, be themselves. If we lose two games in a row, oh, man, you know, somebody's about to get buried. So Stakes would get on the bus. He would understand the tense that the team had. And he would just ball out Bill Cartwright's voice and just loosen everybody up. Then we understood that it was just basketball. It wasn't that serious.
Yeah, able to get the team back in the right frame of mind. And maybe tell me a little bit more about that, because it's one of those things where fans, you see, it's easy to identify when Michael Jordan's doing what he's doing. You mentioned your draft mate, Scottie Pippen, doing all the excellent things he's doing. You doing the dirty work. Like, you know, you were, for a lot of times, were the unsung hero. But at the same time, the true ball knowers know what Ho Grant was doing down on the blocks, playing the defense. But someone like Stacey, like keeping the mood light and just helping you guys achieve those goals, sometimes that's the underrated aspect of teammates that people don't get to see, the fans don't necessarily know about.
A lot of fans don't understand what Stacey, Scott Williams, BJ, and Ed Neely, Bobby Hansen, all those guys did in practice. Those guys pushed us to be excellent. And whenever we Phil set us down and brought that second crew in, we were very comfortable. And Stacey was one of the heads of making us comfortable because he put the work in.
What do you think? Do you know the Bulls have made some changes? Obviously, they hired Bryson Graham, Tiago Splitter. Do you know either men from your days in the around the hoop circles?
I know Tiago.
Okay. So tell me what you think about Tiago and the hiring for the Bulls.
One of the greatest hires ever. And I say that in respect of all the coaches they had in the past. But I know him, watched him with the Spurs, and he just coached my nephew, Jeremy, in Portland.
Sure.
And, of course, I was on the phone with him, and he was like, "Unc, they got a good one." So I rest on that. And, you know, we got a great core of guys. I think it's going to be spectacular. So it's very bright.
Yeah, no, very exciting time. And, no, yeah, that's, of course, obviously, your nephew giving you, I mean, what he was able to do in Portland, considering the circumstances that he was brought into, Chauncey Billups, like that was wild. And so to be able to navigate that and then help them have the season that they had, I mean, that's the thing, Horst. I mean, tell me a little about this, what you think, because a lot of times, especially for Bulls fans, it's championship or bust, right? And if it's not a championship, you know this even for you guys at that point, you know, a lot of times the season was like, yeah, if you don't win the title, it's a failure. But what Tiago Splitter did in Portland this year, I mean, that was about as much a success as you could have expected.
Well, under the circumstances, it was a very successful season. Getting a team like that, with the deal with Chauncey and the young guys, things of that nature, to make them a playoff team, come on, man.
Yeah.
You know, he should have been,
Coach of the Year?
Mentioned as coach.
Okay, fair. Yeah, but it was an unbelievable job by Tiago Splitter, so Bulls fans are very excited about that. Horace Grant joining me. All right, Horace, what do you know about Caleb Wilson, the Bulls' first pick last night, fourth overall, and, you know, kid from UNC, so not like there's any pressure to live up to some hype here. What do you think about the guy the Bulls drafted yesterday?
One of the best picks ever.
Okay.
Watched him when he was playing at North Carolina before he got hurt. A dog. And we need that with the Bulls right now. We need that dog mentality. Athletic, skills, aggressive at the rim, can play defense, and he's so young.
Yes.
He's so young. So great, great pickup. Great pickup.
No, it's exciting because I know everybody, if you read anything, everybody's like, of course, you can always find, you know, guys late in the draft like yourself or Scottie Pippen. Yeah. But, you know, true in terms of like there was a four-tier, you know, players in this draft. But the exciting thing is that a lot of people look at him and they say all that physical talent that he has, that dog mentality that you're mentioning, he could be the prize in this draft if he reaches his true potential.
I think so. In terms of bringing Tiago in as the head coach, and you got Josh here.
Yep.
You got Bruce Ellis, and you got Trey here.
Yep.
So, I mean, he got some good veterans. But this young man, Caleb Wilson, I predict is going to be an all-star in his second year.
Now, I don't know if you heard this, though. Last night, after he was being introduced, he was asked the question about, hey, you went to UNC. The Bulls have a certain history with UNC, a certain player who had a pretty good career. Is there any extra pressure? Did you happen to catch his answer?
Yes.
He said Michael is great, but, you know, I'll paraphrase, but essentially, you know, I'd like to have a better career than Mike. Now, listen, I love the moxie. Yeah. What do you think when you hear a kid say that?
Well, he said that he wanted to write his own story also. But to have a better career of, I say, my goat, man, those are some shoes that it's going to be more difficult to fill. But I love his stance on it, but we'll just wait and see on that.
Fun conversation with Horace Grant as he was here at the ballpark throwing out the first pitch on Wednesday as the White Sox were wrapping up their series with the Guardians. Jeff Meller here at Right Field today, getting set for the 1983 reunion as the White Sox celebrate the winning ugly team, which won the AL West that season. We're going to have a pregame ceremony, which we're going to bring for you during our pregame show. But up next, we are now officially 2 weeks away from the Major League Baseball draft, in which the White Sox hold the number one overall pick. It sounds like it is essentially a three-man race. Maybe we can throw in a fourth if the White Sox are interested in a pitcher. I think that's less likely, but nevertheless, Josh Nelson of Sox Machine, who does a great job not just covering the White Sox, but also breaking down college baseball. He's actually also seen the highest-rated high school prospect in person in Texas. I'm talking about Grady Emerson. So Josh Nelson will bring his expertise to White Sox Weekly as we discuss what the White Sox should potentially do with the number one overall pick in a couple weeks from today. And also, got to talk about this great team on the field as well after a 22-1 thumping of the Royals. We'll do that when we return right here. But you know what? Real quick, before we take a quick timeout, let's pause 10 seconds for stations to identify themselves.
This is ESPN Chicago, home of the White Sox. WMVP WTBC HD2 Chicago, a Good Karma Brands radio station.
All right, when we come back, Josh Nelson of Sox Machine joins me here on ESPN 1000 and the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Cap and Jay Hood, weekday morning, 6 to 9, ESPN Chicago.
White Sox fans, enter the Ultimate Fan Sweepstakes for your chance to win a 2026 suite for a game. The winner will receive a 20-person suite for a regular season White Sox home game. Host your friends and family in luxury while cheering on the Sox. To enter, visit whitesox.com/sweepstakes. Jeff Meller back here at Right Field as we're getting set for game number 2 of 3 between the Sox and Royals. Also going to be celebrating the 1983 winning ugly squad with a reunion today and some pregame festivities, which we will bring you officially on our pregame show, which will kick off at 2:30 today. But on White Sox Weekly, we're now 2 weeks out from the Major League Baseball draft, and the White Sox have the first overall pick. And so what better time to bring on Josh Nelson of Sox Machine to help me discuss what the White Sox should be doing, what he thinks they might be doing. And also, of course, before we get there, Josh does a fantastic job along with James Fegan and Jim Margulis on Sox Machine, just breaking down the ins and outs of your favorite baseball team, the Chicago White Sox. If you're not a subscriber to SoxMachine.com, what are you waiting for? It is definitely worth the price of admission. But so first things first, Josh, before we get to the draft, because of what we saw last night, I'm just going to give you the floor, man. I mean, how fun was that thumping of the Royals, who until this season have been an absolute menace to the White Sox?
Oh, man, what a night. You know, Jeff, in our industry, you have that game and then you get to your work desk and it's like there's too many highlights to cut.
No doubt.
Which is always great news and very unexpected. You know, that was a great series win for the White Sox against the Guardians. You know, we at Sox Machine thought it was a wild series because on one hand, you can make the argument the White Sox could have swept the Guardians. On the other hand, you could have made the argument the Guardians should have swept the White Sox. But to have the day off, and a lot of guys just needed that mental break, like Chase Mydroth needed a day off and Jacob Gonzalez needed a day off. And look at the games that they had yesterday, and I get it's a bullpen day, but Jeff, bullpen games are not always easy for opposing offenses. It's very hard to game plan not knowing who you're going to face every inning. And the way that the entire White Sox offense clicked yesterday, And I know that he got option, but I thought David Sandlin did a very good job bouncing back after walking the bases loaded last night to only allow one run over six innings, which is something that the White Sox really needed so they didn't burn out their bullpen. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's easily one of the best performances we've seen from the Chicago White Sox in years.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Josh Nelson of Sox Machine joining me here on White Sox Weekly. One more note, because you know, I know you're a diehard fan, Josh. You've been covering this team for a long time, and obviously the last 3 years for Sox fans have been difficult ones. But at the same time, where they're at right now, you know, where today after today will be right at the halfway point of the season, but they're 42-38 so far, and what we've seen, and they've done so, you know, for 25 odd games without Munetaka Murakami as well. I mean, and all the moments that they've given the fan base, most of them obviously occurring here at Rate Field, but at the same time, no matter what happens, this has been an unbelievably memorable season.
It really has. And to get everyone more excited, Jeff, if the season were to end today, the White Sox would be the number two seed, meaning that they had a home field advantage in a divisional series. And the way they've been playing at Rate Field, we have to start realistically talking about what could the White Sox do to add to the team that they can make it to the American League Championship Series. Jeff, this team won 61 games last year. Mm-hmm. It's been an incredible turnaround, and everything's been clicking, and it's been such a positive first half of the White Sox that I'm not saying the number one pick is not important. But, man, in December when they won the lottery, it was like, this is going to be the biggest event for the 2026 season for the White Sox. And it's like, I don't even know if it's going to be in the top 10 with all the positivity that's been happening for the White Sox this year and what could happen, especially in the second half.
That is a great point. You know, it's one of those things where I'm in it day to day. I know you are too, but you're maybe a little more locked in because obviously you do such a great job of covering the draft and the prospects. But for me, the day to day of it has been, wow, this team is so exciting. And you're absolutely right. When December rolled around, they won the lottery. They had the first overall pick. I was thinking, I was rolling up my sleeves going, all right, man, this is great. We've got something to look forward to all summer long. Because obviously, as you mentioned, you know, they still had like ways to go, but it's something that is kind of, you know, it's been on the periphery because of the way they've played so far this year. Nevertheless, it is quickly approaching. And all right, so Brendan Riley, my executive producer, noted how the other day he saw a Rocky UCLA jersey in the stands here at Rate Field. Probably no surprise when I say that, but it's funny because what seemed like, at least in December, a likely no-doubt decision has all of a sudden, I think, as we get closer, become a lot more of a conversation with both Grady Emerson and Vaughn Lackey making their plea for why they should potentially be a first overall pick.
Well, on opening day in Milwaukee, I saw someone have a Rock Chalowski White Sox jersey already.
That's bold.
So if you're a Sox fan that's got a Rock Chalowski White Sox jersey, you're going to be sweating. I don't think, Jeff, we're really going to know until like 10 minutes before the White Sox announce who they're taking first overall. Mm-hmm. And that is, to your point, a change from even in March when Rock Chalowski had a really strong start to the season. What has happened over the course of this season is that when Big Ten conference play started, Rock Chalowski was expected to just skyrocket because the pitching in the Big Ten is not all that great. That didn't happen. And Vaughn Lackey had an amazing ACC season, and he was displaying elite athleticism that we typically do not see behind home plate at the catching position. And then there's so much wood bat data, and we have a better understanding of how teenagers can develop not only on the international front, but on the high school front, that a lot of the metrics that Grady Emerson has displayed is a lot of them are on par with Bobby Witt Jr. when he was taken second overall. So it just opened the door to teams to reevaluate what is the ceiling of these three players. The entire industry agrees these are the top three players, but what order that you would rank them is up to that person's preference. And that makes it very frustrating when people ask me, what are the White Sox going to be doing in the number one pick? Jeff, the answer is, I don't know. And we're not going to probably know until July 11th. But right now, I still think there is a healthy debate between either taking Grady Emerson, the 18-year-old high school shortstop out of Texas, or Rock Chalowski, the shortstop out of UCLA. I still think that is the debate.
Now, listen, I've been around this game long enough, Josh. I'm sure you have been as well. I know general managers, they'll always tell you best player available. You can't worry about what you have on your team, in your organization. But I also understand that whenever they make the pick, after they make the pick, they're going to represent that no matter who they took, that that was in their mind the best player. But the way Colson Montgomery has played defensively at shortstop, and also factoring in that Billy Carlson, who, you know, listen, how the bat develops, we shall see. But they invested a lot in him as their, you know, first round pick last year. And he is a glove first shortstop. In fact, everybody basically said he's the best defensive shortstop as a high schooler that they ever saw. So when you have Colson playing as well as he's playing at shortstop, you've got Billy Carlson already in the system, you know. For me, I look at Chalowski, and I know a lot of his value is tied up in being a gold glove caliber shortstop. And, you know, he's 22. He's got, you mentioned the wood bat data that doesn't necessarily go in his favor. And then I look at someone like Grady Emerson, who's 18, and his value is more tied up in his hit tool. And so part of me is thinking, you know, is it better for the White Sox, who have shown a better propensity at developing their younger players these days as well, are they better off taking the high school shortstop who maybe has a little bit more ceiling than someone like Rock Chalowski?
In my opinion, yes. That's why I have Grady Emerson number one on Sox Machine's top 150 prospects, because a lot of points that you have made, and you didn't mention Caleb Bonnemer, mm-hmm. who's the White Sox top position player prospect.
I've already moved him to second base or center field, Josh. That's in my head because of Colson and Carlson, but you're right.
And that's fine. Bonnemer also drafted out of high school in Michigan. Colson Montgomery drafted out of high school in Indiana. We got some good news today pregame about Noah Schultz maybe rejoining the White Sox sooner than later. Mm-hmm. High schooler out of Illinois. We know that White Sox director of amateur scouting, Mike Shirley, prefers high schoolers over players. So this decision was solely on his shoulders. I would be confident to say, yes, it's going to be Grady Emerson at number one overall. But did Rock Chalowski play that poorly in the second half to change what everybody thought in March was going to be the slam dunk number one overall pick? I don't think so. I think if you gave Rock Chalowski to Ryan Fuller and Derek Showman and break down his swing mm-hmm. and realize, get him to focus more on pulling pitches and ignore the pitches in the outside corner and get him back to what he was so good at the first half of the season, you could have a 25 to 30 home run type of power hitter that could move over to third base as well in the future for the White Sox. In my opinion, the White Sox are in a no-lose situation here. Whether they take Grady Emerson or Rock Chalowski, I think that's a great player they can add to their farm system. Now, what makes this contentious? We are hearing that Tampa Bay prefers Vaughn Lacky over both, which means that whoever the White Sox don't take is likely to be the third overall pick, and that's the Minnesota Twins. So this debate will never end, Jeff. We'll be constantly comparing these two, so that's how I feel. Like, White Sox either take Chalowski or Emerson first overall. Twins will take whoever the White Sox don't. I think that's how it'll break down the top three.
Yeah, you know, ultimately, then no matter what I think Chalowski probably has the safer floor because of his age and where he's already at developmentally. I think, like you pointed out, I think Grady Emerson maybe has the higher upside. So the one thing I'll say is I hope that they resist, you know, it's silly, but I do think the name Rock Chalowski, you know, in Chicago plays,
yeah,
and everybody has been, you know, and it's one of those things where it really shouldn't. But I hope the White Sox can, you know, kind of distance themselves and just, you know, get into a room with all the people who they trust, all, you know, Mike Shirley, you know, like you said, whether, you know, obviously Ryan Fuller, Chris Getz, everybody, Will Venable, let Derek Showman, let them all get in there and discuss it and be like, all right, we got to set everything else aside. Who's going to be the best player for this organization? We can't be scared, because the truth is, Josh, that in a MLB draft, they're already going to be having these conversations about Jack Caglione, who's here today, right? With Hagen Smith, as soon as he gets up, if he's not performing, it's forever going to be a conversation piece.
Yes. And, you know, the other thing with Grady Emerson, and I mean, there's just such good bat data, wood bat data, and he is one of the few high schoolers ever to be a nominated for the Golden Spikes Award. I think Bobby Witt Jr. is the other one. That we just had the White Sox face the Tigers last week in Detroit. And Jeff, we saw how much of an impact Kevin McConnell made on that series against White Sox pitchers. McConnell's 21. It did not take him very long to get to the majors. I watched the highlights last night. Connor Griffin just hit a upper deck home run for the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Yep.
We used to think high schoolers needed 3 or 4 years to reach the majors. I don't think that's going to be the case with Grady Emerson. Yeah, he's 18 right now, but he may only need 2 years to be major league ready. So we could be talking about at 21 years old, instead of facing Big Ten pitching like Rock Chalowski did, Grady Emerson could be following the footsteps of like a Kevin McConnell and helping out the Chicago White Sox in the majors. And that is a huge benefit to any MLB team. This is why I think, especially with this draft and what we are hearing, it's going to happen in the first round, especially in the late part of the first round. Major League Baseball team is going to spend the majority of their pool trying to get younger. You're going to see a run of high school players, especially in the first round, even though I thought and many throughout the industry thought that this would be a very heavy college hitter draft. It could be in the first half of the first round, but late first round into the second round, we're going to see a lot of high schoolers taken.
Yeah, no doubt the impending next CBA could obviously change the way some teams view this draft ever so slightly. Last thing, Josh, as I let you go here, we've spent a lot of time, obviously, on Grady Emerson and Rock Chalowski, but we did talk about Vaughn Lacky a little bit there, and I'll just mention his name, Jackson Flora, thought of as the best pitching prospect in this draft. So Lacky, Flora, obviously, we think, I mean, at least talking to you, it seems like you, like I believe it'll probably be Emerson or Chalowski for the Sox, but what about Lacky and Flora? Do you think those are probably not players that the White Sox are realistically considering?
Well, I think Lackey's in the conversation. So okay. If I had to do a percentage, it's 45% for Chalowski and Emerson and 10% for Lacky. Just because he's a late incoming into the conversation, Jacob Lombard at one point was part of the conversation. Justin LeBron was one part of the conversation. Lackey's got tremendous power. He's got tremendous pop time, a 1.7 transition from home to second. Great throwing arm. He could play third. If you want to put him in the outfield, he could definitely do that. And he really tapped into his power this year. So, but it's just one good year of college baseball. The first 2 years, the data is not all that great. Jackson Flora, I think, is the most major league ready player in this MLB draft. I think he's got 3+ pitches. The changeup consistently was getting better. Yes, opposing teams were trying to jump on the fastball because they did not have a prayer against his slider, cutter, and sweeper combination, and his fastball can reach triple digits. I think he's a very special pitcher. His teammate Tyler Bremner went second overall to the Angels. I'm expecting Flora to be taken in the top five, and I've been getting asked this a lot because the White Sox need starting pitching help. I don't think Flora is part of the conversation, but if you ever had to draft by need, I think you would be a more serious contender to be first overall. But I do think Jackson Flora is a pretty special pitcher, and whoever takes him, I think they have someone that could really rise fast in their system.
Great stuff, Josh. That is Josh Nelson again of Sox Machine. If you're not a subscriber but you're a Sox fan, you are certainly missing out. He, James Fegan, and Jim Margulis do fantastic work. So if you want more information like that, check out SoxMachine.com. Josh, as always, thank you. Appreciate the insight, my friend.
Absolutely. Have a great day.
You too. Again, Josh Nelson of Sox Machine. I'm Jeff Meller here at Rate Field. We're getting set for the celebration 1983 winning ugly team, which will be coming your way in our pregame at 2:30. But before we do that, we're going to take one last break. And when I come back, we had an interesting note regarding the Pope and the 2005 Chicago White Sox. I will share that with you if you missed it earlier this week. This is the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Jeff Meller takes your calls after the game, ESPN Chicago.
They're two strikes away from a win here in 2005 in Game 1 with Jenks on the mound and Everett at the plate. Game 1 to the White Sox.
Spencer Jinks is anything but tonight. Turning 25 during the end of the year, pitching like a postseason veteran, coming out, striking out three of the four hitters he faced. Contreras gets the win. The White Sox take game one, 5-3.
What a fantastic moment back in 2005. The late Bobby Jenks closing out the first game of the World Series against the Houston Astros. And if you're asking yourself, hey, Meller, why are you playing the 05 final outs of game one when the White Sox are celebrating the 1983 winning ugly team? Well, I have an update for you about said ball. If you missed it, A.J. Pierzynski, who was in possession of that final out from game one of the World Series, well, he visited a certain White Sox fan in Rome, who you may be familiar with. You know, his friends call him Roberts. You and I, we call him Pope Leo the 14th. And Pope Leo was visited by A.J. Pierzynski, and A.J. Pierzynski gave his final outs ball of game one to the Pope. And what we learned per A.J. Pierzynski as he was walking away and he handed the ball to the Pope apparently informed A.J. Pierzynski that he said, oh my gosh, this is unbelievable. No way, this is the ball. And then he followed up and said, I was at game two, too, but nobody knows that. They didn't find me. So the Pope, according to A.J. Pierzynski, told him that he was also at game two of the World Series in 2005. That's going to do it for this edition of White Sox Weekly. But when we come back, we are going to set the stage as the White Sox get set to celebrate the 1983 winning ugly team prior to today's first pitch between the White Sox and Royals, game number 2 of 3. We'll do that in a couple of minutes right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.